The following is a lecture by Dr. Richard Floyd, a professor of history at the University of Virginia and author of Church, Chapel, and Party, Religious Dissent and Political Modernization in 19th Century England. He spoke on the American Civil War from the British perspective on Sunday, June 12th, as part of the James Madison Museum's 2011 lecture series.
Thank you to all of you for coming out here this afternoon. I like to talk about history. It is it's what I do professionally. It is arguably what I do best. It is what I enjoy doing, and I enjoy doing it all the more so when I have audiences that are not there by compunction, and when I have audiences that I do not have to worry about having to grade and evaluate at the end of the semester. So there will be no questions before you are let out this afternoon. Today we are talking about, or I'm talking about, British perspectives on the American Civil War. I'd like to begin by stepping back slightly from the Civil War years to take a slightly broader view and to consider more general British attitudes towards America and to Americans in the first half of the 19th century. And as you might expect, these varied from person to person, and depending on an individual's individual beliefs. Many living in 19th century Britain saw the young American Republic as an inspiration. It was democracy at work. It was a republic. It was a res publica, or a thing of the people, and it really worked. The Chartists were one group in British society who were undoubted fans of America. Chartists espoused Chartism, which was a movement sympathetic to the plight of the working classes. And they took their name from a charter, which they wished to have endorsed by the British Parliament. The goals of this charter were very radical in scope, and if they were secured, they would have realigned Britain's traditional socially hierarchical system to much more closely parallel American meritocracy. Chartism, of course, with its radical aims, Chartism did not really reflect mainstream thinking in 19th century Britain, but it is worth pointing out that of the two great political parties of the second half of the 19th century in Britain, one of these, the Liberals, they were, in terms of personnel and ideology, the Liberals were the heirs to an earlier Whig party. And just as today in America there are Republicans who are red and there are Democrats who are blue, well, 19th century British political parties also had colors. And the colors of these Whigs had been blue and buff, or if you prefer, yellow and blue. Why is this significant? Well, those had been the colors of the uniforms of the Continental Army of General George Washington. And the Whigs, the British Whigs, had been, long before 1776, the Whigs had been the champions of American independence from Great Britain. In the decades following 1776, or 1781 perhaps, most British Whigs had been very satisfied with the direction that the new republic was steering. This transatlantic admiration could go both ways, for there also was, of course, a Whig party in the United States of America. This was the party of Daniel Webster and of Henry Clay. It also was the party of no fewer than three of our eight Virginia presidents, William Henry Harrison, John Tyler, Orange County's own Zachary Taylor had all been Whigs. And the American Whigs, their choice of the name Whig was by no means accidental. British Whigs in the 18th century, they had championed the supremacy of Parliament, particularly the popularly elected House of Commons, over the mighty and grasping Hanoverian kings, particularly King George III. And the American Whig Party, it rose up in response to the two administrations of Andrew Jackson, whom they derided as King Andrew. More especially, they supported the supremacy of an elected legislative branch, Congress, over the grasping and powerful executive branch, or the U.S. presidency. So you can see parallels between these two Whig parties. And in some respects, there were very good feelings felt by the British for the Americans. Of course, not everyone in Britain saw the United States in such a rosy, positive light. And as well as liberals, Britain also had a conservative party. Conservatives were the intellectual heirs, or the ideological heirs, and intellectual, to the British Tory Party. And Tory is another name that shows up in American history as those who had opposed American independence in the 1760s and 70s and 80s. Many British conservatives recognized the USA as the writing on the wall. They saw that that's the way things were going, but they didn't like what they read. More traditional-minded advocates of hierarchy and status and people sticking to their own place, they tended to disapprove of the young republic. One interesting case in point was Frances Milton Trollope, who was the mother of the 19th century novelist, Anthony Trollope, and her story is an interesting one. The Trollope family had run into financial difficulties in the 1820s, and Mrs. Trollope decided to sink her remaining capital in the wilds of the American frontier in Cincinnati, Ohio. Her idea was very interesting. Her notion was that even in the backwoods wilds of the Ohio River Valley, she reckoned that there would still be a yearning for style and sophistication, and who better provide this, she reckoned, than a transplanted English lady. It's an interesting idea. We must admire Mrs. Trollope's entrepreneurial outlook. Of course, what is it? 9 out of 10 entrepreneurial ventures fail in the first 12 months, I believe. Her case was no different. She had a neat idea, except it didn't work out. Frances Trollope hated everything she found in Cincinnati. If you think hate is perhaps too strong a word, let me simply read to you a single sentence from her 1832 bestseller, Domestic Manners of the Americans. She said, and I quote, "I hate America." That's what she had to say. Cincinnati was a crude center of the pork butchering trade in the 1820s. American women were prettier than British or European women. Mrs. Trollope allowed that, but prettiness aside, they were vulgar and ignorant. No one in Cincinnati respected class or station. Even the servants tended to be uppity. They expected to share their meals with the families whom they ostensibly served. This, needless to say, was very, very different from contemporary ideals of an English servant who was seen and not heard. Really, did his or her task and was not thought about much at all. Therefore, Mrs. Trollope returned home exasperated. She wrote her best-selling book about the, and again I quote, "the shockingly raw and uncouth Americans whom she hated." Generations of defenders of social hierarchy, they could then point to the domestic manners of the Americans, and they could see this as a warning of what might happen in Britain if the franchise were widened, if tendencies to discount place and station persisted, if there were a leveling of class distinction, and so on and so on. This was, once again, the writing on the wall, and they didn't like what they saw. Another interesting avenue for evaluating British attitudes towards America, and perhaps American attitudes towards Britain in the antebellum years, would be literary tastes. And for the most part, common English language, for the most part, these tastes were very, very amicable. Any guesses as to who was the most famous author, American or British, in the United States in the 18-teens and 20s and 30s? In fact, it was Sir Walter Scott. He was the most famous author in America. He was the most famous author in Britain as well. Scott died, I believe, in 1832. And a few years later, he was superseded as the most popular author in Britain and in America by a young journalist and essayist who would turn novelist and editor, Charles Dickens. He was wildly popular in Britain. He was wildly popular in America. We'll talk more about Dickens in a moment. The Scott angle, though, is worth developing a little further in our examination, not merely of British perspectives on the Civil War, but British influences on the Civil War. I suspect that some of us may be familiar with Mark Twain's famous quip that the American Civil War was caused by Sir Walter Scott. That might seem an outrageous suggestion in its own right, so the context is that Mark Twain's point was that Miguel Cervantes had, in his epic Don Quixote, he had done a great service to the world in dashing to pieces that obsession, first in Europe, later in America, the obsession with chivalrous medieval nonsense, as he saw it. Walter Scott, in turn, through novels such as Ivanhoe and Rob Roy and The Talisman, Scott had turned back the clock and revived those sentiments, the notions of loyalty and honor and chivalry that were key to the Confederate cause. They were, according to Walter Scott, Mark Twain rather, they were romanticized by, they were even caused by the enthusiasm for the writings of Sir Walter Scott. And after the Civil War, of course, the Ku Klux Klan, it would draw its inspiration from the Klans of Scotland. The novel from which the film Birth of a Nation was based was called simply The Klansman. With a C, not a K, but the image of the burning cross, which today is a symbol of intimidation, was originally a Scottish device that was used to rally the clans. The last occasion that I know this was used, and it may have happened in small isolated instances subsequently, but the last big time that the crosses were burning in Scotland had been the Jacobite Rising of 1745. This was intended to restore the Stuart dynasty, which in turn we can associate with the Cavaliers, which in turn perhaps we can associate with the University of Virginia. That might be taking things too far. But it is described in Scott's novels with a flourish, and that's where people got these ideas of it. That's how Scott's nationalist or culturalist or clannish, whatever they happen to be, how they identify and rally themselves. Returning to Charles Dickens, he made a very famous lecture circuit of the USA in 1842. He toured Virginia at some point. I'm not aware that he came through Orange County or Albemarle County. He did spend considerable time in Richmond, and pretty much he was lionized wherever he went, except for when he began harping on international copyright laws, or rather the lack thereof, because his works had for years been being pirated and sold in the United States of America without him getting any royalties. That was something he didn't like. Besides that, he thought America was interesting. Certainly America was worth writing about. So clearly English or Scottish or British writers were popular in America. The yin to the yang of this was that Americans who hoped to be popular and successful in America, pretty much first had to find their publishers in Britain. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Washington Irving, I don't know about you, but for me, Washington Irving is almost quintessentially American. He has his five-volume biography, he has his first name, among other things. He also has his five-volume biography of George Washington. But all of those guys, they were very, very famous in America, but first they had been very, very famous and successful in Britain. The praise and the acclaim, the positive reviews from critics in Britain, those were priceless to an American author just starting out because it was a clear sign of success and validation. And the manifest political independence of the United States notwithstanding, there still persisted some kind of intellectual or cultural inferiority, with the result that American authors who wanted to be popular and famous, they had to first strike it successful in Britain. Once that had happened, then British or American publishers and American readers would be interested in their work. The point of all of this, I guess, is that Anglo-American relations on the eve of the American Civil War were complex, and we've not really even gotten to politics yet. In political respects, in the realm of weighty matters of politics and diplomacy and trade and commerce, in those respects, the outbreak of hostilities in April of 1861 demanded some clarification. The American Civil War posed an obvious dilemma to British politicians. One immediate issue was that both sides, the Union and the Confederacy, both the North and the South, tried to secure a formal alliance with Great Britain. Britain was the world's most powerful nation in 1861. The United States of America simply was not. One interesting demonstration of this, of the relative strengths of the USA and the UK, One demonstration of this is revealed through America's choice of ambassadors to the United Kingdom at the time. After all, weak and inconsequential countries, they always aim to send their best, their most important, most promising men to represent themselves before powerful and influential countries. They want to put their best foot forward, so to speak. Strong countries, on the other hand, they have the luxury of sending out whomever they damn well please to be ambassador to a weak or inconsequential country. And if you scan the list of U.S. ambassadors to the Court of St. James in the antebellum period, you will see that no fewer than five of them, that is, one out of every three U.S. presidents from 1801 to 1861, had earlier cut his teeth wearing out the seat of the American ambassadorship in London. That was an important way to prove what your merit was, and the United States wanted to send the best to Britain. Now, in 1861, both the Confederacy and the Union wanted to be on Britain's good side. So much so that Abraham Lincoln's appointment as ambassador to Britain was the son of one former U.S. president and former ambassador to Britain, and the grandson of another former U.S. president and former ambassador to Britain. This was Charles Francis Adams Sr. So he really was throwing the best of the best that he had to try and impress the British. It's always nice to be courted from both sides, so it boiled down to what were the British interests, what really were British interests in all this. There were, among other things, economic considerations. Britain was the workshop of the world, and its greatest industry was in textiles. Cotton from the American South, planted and picked and cleaned by black slaves, American cotton fed the industrial factories of Lancashire and Yorkshire, and all this transatlantic commerce fueled booming port cities such as Liverpool and Hull and Bristol. Regarding Liverpool, we'll come back to that, there's a bit more I want to say about that, but I suspect several of you know that Liverpool cotton importers, they had set up, it was illegal and unofficial, but they had set up an unofficial embassy to the Confederate States of America in 1861. Indeed, James Dunwoody Bullock, who was the commander of the Confederate Navy, he based his headquarters in Liverpool, and he never, ever left the city. I'm not talking about just the duration of the war. He stayed in Liverpool for the rest of his life. He died there in the early 20th century, and his tombstone, if you visit it, reads, "An American by birth, an Englishman by choice." The very first act of the war, that is the first shot fired at Fort Sumter on April 11th, 1861, it was fired from a cannon that had been cast and bored at Lydia Ann Street in Liverpool, and arguably the very last act of the war also occurred in Liverpool, when on the 6th of November, 1865, Captain Waddell of the CSS Shenandoah, he walked up the steps of the town hall with a letter to the Prime Minister in which he surrendered the vessel to the British Navy, represented in this instance by the Lord Mayor of Liverpool. So there are some very interesting ties between the Confederacy and Great Britain. The northern United States, they also had some industry, this is true. They did trade with Britain to some degree, this is true, but 75% of U.S. exports at this time consisted of southern cotton bound for Lancashire. Therefore, it is not surprising to learn that of all of the parties watching and waiting and evaluating the deteriorating relations between the northern and southern states in the late 1850s, especially in the early 1860s, well, British mill owners were among the most observant. They had, in fact, stockpiled their cotton supplies in the run-up to hostilities so that they did have a reserve to work with in the spring and summer of 1861. During this time, they gradually shifted their supply over to India. So in that respect, the Confederate States were not completely essential to the British economy. It would seem the Confederates would not have that card to play. Moreover, for the British to prosper commercially, it was important that they export as well. For example, heavy manufactured goods, as well as personnel and expertise, And in those instances, the northern United States were much more important than the southern United States. So if you throw in moral questions of slavery into the mix, as well as the long-term economic advantage of cultivating business relations with a sophisticated and long-term economy, rather than, you know, the South essentially had a medieval economy at this time, from those perspectives, it might have looked as though Britain's best interests lay with the Union, except it was not quite that straightforward. Because there were compelling reasons to justify Britain's supporting the Confederacy as well. From a calculating and cynical perspective, perhaps from simply a disinterested geopolitical perspective of realpolitik, perhaps two Americas could be a better thing than one. Britain's prime minister, a man named Lord Palmerston, whose real political strong point had always been foreign affairs anyway, Palmerston said exactly that, that Britain could always benefit from the weakness of others, and hey, it is better to deal with two relatively weaker Americas than with one united, relatively stronger America. Palmerston's belief in hierarchy also inclined him to favor the South. He was, after all, a peer of the realm. He was Lord Palmerston, not Mr. Palmerston. And he was almost gleeful when the great experiment of a Republican Union failed. In the event that the Confederacy could pull it off, if it could become a viable nation or a viable state, and in the event that Britain happened to forge a formal alliance with the Confederate States, Palmerston seriously considered the proposition that my friend's enemies are my enemies and the necessity of prosecuting war against the northern United States. For reasons that we shall see, Lincoln also seriously considered declaring war on Great Britain in the first year of the war. I'm not sure, and I don't believe Lincoln planned out the finer points of this. Palmerston certainly did. And how would he go to war against the United States? Well, he would do it by way of Canada. The only way to deal with the United States, Palmerston said, was to be strong at sea and to be present at Canada. And in that sense, you could close in on the North and you could defeat the North. In some ways, this accepting policy toward Southern independence, this might also have looked simply like accepting the inevitable. After all, Palmerston and his foreign secretary, Lord John Russell, who was a very liberal fellow, both of them expected the South to win. And as we know, this seemed perfectly plausible for during the first year of the fighting, given the outcome of the first Battle of Bull Run, given that string of incompetent Union generals, it looked quite likely that the South could have a quick success, a quick victory. Palmerston was technically one of those liberal British politicians, but there were certain ways, he actually had held office with conservative governments as well, and there were some ways that he was simply conservative. If nothing else, he was quite old. He had been born in the 1780s. He was therefore himself close to being fourscore and 7 years at this time. And he and other conservatives could see the South as not being that bad a thing. Even from the left wing of the British political spectrum, though, among the radicals in Parliament, some of them, they allowed that it's bad to enslave blacks. Fair enough. But maybe the North wasn't that much better. Black slaves in cotton fields laboring from sunup to sundown. White factory hands laboring from sunup to sundown. Yeah, the white gets a wage, but is it the living wage? Questions people ask in the 21st century. The Southern master, at least, provided food and clothing and shelter and everything else, and that was something that the mill owners did not provide. That was the position, actually, of John Roebuck, who was a radical MP, a member of Parliament for a constituency in Sheffield. Charles Dickens himself, I'm pretty sure he was no friend of the Confederacy, but he was very critical of bleeding-heart liberals in Britain who lamented the pitiable plight of blacks and browns and yellows in Africa and in Asia and the Pacific Islands and the American South, while British factory workers arguably had it no better. His notion was that charity ought to start at home. When you've cleaned up your own house, then you can start saying, no, 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 you shouldn't do this, that. You ought to help those people and those people. Another argument that could be developed in favor of the South was one that was informed by culture, that therefore tended to transcend political affiliation. And this was the perception that the South, Southerners, that they were Englishmen. The North, on the other hand, well, maybe the best families and the earliest families had been English, although there are a lot of Dutch in New York and a lot of Germans in Pennsylvania. But beyond that, there were a whole lot of miscellaneous immigrant rabble. Contemporary anti-Irish propaganda fits into this picture, and the South is more uniquely, more authentically English or British. More substantially, Victorian Britons, especially liberal Victorian Britons, they believed in freedom, and therefore they were inclined to champion independence movements. The United States from Britain, back in 1776, I mentioned that already, Latin American republics from Spanish or Portuguese authority in the 18-teens and 20s, European independence movements as well. The 19th century was a great age of national awakening in Europe. There were Garibaldi and Mazzini in Italy. They both were great heroes to the British. There was Louis Kossuth in Hungary. He was a great hero to the liberal British in the 1840s and 50s and 60s and 70s. So maybe the American South, like the American North, 4 score and 7 years earlier, like Mexico and Venezuela and Hungary and Italy, maybe the American South ought to be independent. As William Gladstone, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time, he was later on Prime Minister 4 times, as Gladstone put it, Jefferson Davis and the Southern states, they had made an army. It looked very much like they were on their way to making a navy, and more difficult than either of these, they had made a nation. There was a unique, authentic Confederate nation. And in this light, the North was the aggressor. And the Southerners were plucky nationalist fellows who simply wanted to govern themselves. Again, this argument seemed particularly plausible during the first couple of years of the war when, as we know, Abraham Lincoln declined to insist that the war was a war being fought to end slavery. Lincoln did not like slavery, but he was even more terrified of alienating Maryland and Kentucky and Missouri. So he repeated again and again and again that it was all about preserving the Union. Of course, preserving a state. I mean, the Tsarist Romanovs or the Austrian Habsburgs or the Spanish and the French Bourbon of Europe, they could be just as jealous of their dynastic inheritances. They also would fight tooth and nail to quash nationalist independence movements in Italy or in Hungary or in Poland or something like that. And maybe that's what Abraham Lincoln in the North is doing, while the South is trying to assert its own national character. For all that, the balance probably all along really was tipped in the direction of Britain's favoring the Union. National freedom is a great argument, but then there is the other side of this argument. There is the obvious question of personal freedom, the personal freedom of the black slave. This clearly would be denied in the Confederate States of America. And this meant that there were always practical, political, there were religious, there were humane reasons to justify condemning the Southern states. I've mentioned the popularity of Longfellow and Irving and Company in Britain in the years leading up to the American Civil War. Two other American authors who were quite successful in Britain were Frederick Douglass and Harriet Beecher Stowe. Their writings were very popular, and indeed, Uncle Tom's Cabin had, on the eve of the Civil War, it had sold more copies in Britain than it had in North America. Both Douglass and Stowe, they made the lecture circuit in Britain, just like Charles Dickens had. They raised awareness and money for the abolitionist cause. Harriet Beecher Stowe, in fact, she had personal meetings both with Palmerston, who at this time was Foreign Secretary, and with Queen Victoria. Additionally, Britain had itself abolished slavery some years ahead of the Southern states of America. Slavery was abolished in Britain and its colonial plantations in 1833 to 1838. It was a step-by-step incremental process. And actually, just as British textile manufacturers had kept an eye on the South in the 1850s and early 1860s, American Southerners had kept an eye on the abolitionist arguments in Britain in the 18-teens and 20s and 30s. And they felt at the time, and they continued to feel a generation afterwards, anxious about having been abandoned to the rest of the world, especially as Britain in particular now took the lead in this attempt to stamp out slavery all over the planet. And as I've suggested, once the Emancipation Proclamation was proclaimed, I guess, the ambiguity over what the war was about or why it was being fought, this was dispelled, and it became clear which side the British really ought to support. Even though, again, as we've seen, even though the commercial interests of the mill owners of Lancashire or Yorkshire, they may have been linked intimately to the slave economy, even though that was the case, many of the mill owners were Quakers or other austere religious nonconformists who were and who always had been dyed-in-the-wool abolitionists. One notable example was John Bright, who was a Quaker and a member of Parliament. He and fellow parliamentarian Richard Cobden, they were so prominent as advocates of egalitarianism and similar ideologies that they were often described in the House of Commons as being the honorable members for the United States of America. And they were strong advocates for the Union against the South. It was not only the mill owners who sympathized with the North and who condemned the South, however. Karl Marx wrote extensively of his delight that mill operatives, simple people, many of them who had been put out of work because of Union blockades of Southern ports, many mill operatives, against their personal economic interests, but in step with what Marx perceived to be the class consciousness of a mutual experience of shared oppression, they enthusiastically rallied behind the Unionist cause. This, Karl Marx believed, was proof positive of historical inevitability and his theory of dialectic materialism, and that the Communist Revolution was destined to start very, very soon in the British Isles. He may have been right in some respects, he clearly was wrong in other respects. So it is safe to say that certain arguments to the contrary notwithstanding, at the end of the day, Britain was going to side with the established legitimate government of Abraham Lincoln and the United States Congress. That is a simple thing to say, but the decision did not mean that there would be that the 4 years of fighting would be smooth or trouble-free. There were several diplomatic incidents during the war that affected Anglo-American relations, and one of these was the Trent Affair. Early in the war, in November of 1861, the Confederacy tried to send two talented diplomats, James Mason of Virginia and George Slidell of Louisiana, to negotiate with the British government for official recognition, which might be the first step towards the formal alliance. They were traveling on this Trent. The Trent was a British vessel. It flew a British flag. They therefore were under British protection. But a Union vessel, a screw frigate called the San Jacinto, with Charles Wilkes as captain, the San Jacinto intercepted the Trent on the high seas. They arrested Mason and Slidell as contrabands of war, and they were brought back for trial to New York City. Prime Minister Palmerston, he called this an act of piracy, and he prepared a scathing letter to President Lincoln, which went just short of declaring war if Mason and Slidell were not released immediately. The letter was shown to the Queen and to her husband, Prince Albert, before being sent, however, and Albert was on his deathbed at this point. He actually died just a few days afterwards, but he recommended that the letter be slightly edited before being sent. Specifically, a section was added to the tune of, "Of course, Mr. Lincoln, you didn't plan for this to happen. You, Mr. Lincoln, you were treated very poorly by your commanding officer, Captain Wilkes. He very clearly extended his portfolio. He clearly acted without orders. This must be very disappointing. This must be very galling to you, strong Mr. Lincoln, that you are," and so on and so on and so on. And that's how the letter, in fact, was sent. And that's how Lincoln read it, and he took full advantage of this. He agreed that Wilkes had been out of order, that he had gone beyond his portfolio. Mason and Slidell were, in fact, released. They continued their mission, and Lincoln was able to save face. Anglo-American relations were able to be more or less intact over this. The Union also sent diplomats in efforts to prevent the development of an Anglo-Confederate alliance. Specifically, Lincoln sent the U.S. ambassador, Charles Francis Adams, whom I mentioned. He was the son of John Quincy Adams, the grandson of John Adams. Charles Francis Adams and his son, Henry Adams, who later on write The Education of Henry Adams, well, they went, And they skillfully negotiated in Whitehall to prevent the British government from recognizing the CSA. Furthermore, this ties into this question, many Britons were great admirers of Abraham Lincoln and his style as president. If there are any readers of the news magazine The Economist in the audience today, you will know that The Economist's weekly editorial on Britain is called Badgett. It was named after Walter Badgett, who was, among other things, he was the son-in-law of the newspaper's founder, and he was, for a number of years in the mid-19th century, one of its chief contributors. Walter Badgett also was a prolific commentator on the relative strengths and weaknesses of the British and American political systems. And he wrote an essay, it's a generally positive essay, on Lincoln as president and his style of leadership. So good feelings in that respect. Another great admirer of Abraham Lincoln's was Queen Victoria. She was herself widowed during the Civil War. I mentioned Albert's deathbed contribution to resolving the Trent Affair. I'd like to read to you the letter that she sent to Mary Todd Lincoln after Lincoln's assassination. This is April 29, 1865. "Dear Madam," she wrote, though a stranger to you, I cannot remain silent when so terrible calamity has fallen upon you and your country. And I must personally express my deep-felt and heartfelt sympathy with you under the shocking circumstances of your present dreadful misfortune. No one can better appreciate than I, who am myself utterly broken-hearted by the loss of my own beloved husband, who was the light of my life, my stay, my all, what your suffering must be, and I earnestly pray that you may be supported by him to whom alone the sorely stricken can look for comfort in this hour of heavy affliction. With a renewed expression of true sympathy, I remain, my dear madam, your sincere friend, Victoria Regina." One other sticky point for Anglo-American relations during the Civil War involved the question of supplying gunboats and other weapons of war. Britain was, of course, the supreme naval power on the planet and the supreme industrial power on the planet in the 1860s, and from Liverpool to Manchester to Birmingham, that triangle was the military-industrial complex capital of the world. They had the market on this, and the Union and the Confederacy alike would have been happy to have had access to British expertise and British hardware. The Confederacy, of course, needed this a lot more. They had very little native industry of its own. However, as a neutral power, Britain had no right to supply either side with assistance or military material. Individual British merchants, however, they tried to find ways around these matters. One example, and I suspect this is the most famous example, the Confederate States Navy commissioned a screw sloop of war from Jonathan Laird, a shipbuilder in Birkenhead, which is just across the River Mersey from Liverpool. This was technically all hush-hush, but everybody knew it was going on. The sloop was not given a name. It simply was identified by its hull number, which was, anybody know the hull number? There's a song that would lead you to believe that it was 292. In fact, it was 290. But this ship without a name sailed out of Birkenhead to Terceira Island in the Azores. There it had its armor and its guns, which actually also had been made at Birkenhead. Actually, I don't think the armor and the guns were made at Birkenhead. I think they were made in Liverpool, which is just across the river. But anyway, in the Azores, it was refitted and it was made into a naval cruiser with the intention of it serving as a commerce raider. Now, technically, no one had built anyone a warship. Technically, no one had sold or bought a warship to or from anyone. But you get the picture. And you can imagine what Laird's argument might have been. Yes, Your Honor, he walked out with a pack of shotgun shells and a plastic bag in one hand and a shotgun in the other, but how was I to know he was going to, you know, put them together? Something along those lines. Clearly, this violated the spirit, if not necessarily the letter of the law, of these neutrality laws. Charles Francis Adams, he protested to the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister's legal advisors, they hemmed and hawed. But in the meantime, the ship had got to the Portuguese-owned Azores and had become an unambiguous battle of warship, rechristened the Alabama. I suspect many of you know the details, if only from the song, the refrain, "Roll, Alabama, roll." Some of us at least know the song. Lots of Union sailors were killed. A lot of Northern commerce was wrecked. And letter of the law notwithstanding, Britain was clearly, well, probably not clear, but Britain was probably to some extent guilty. This continued to cause ill feeling after the war. The matter finally was resolved only when the so-called Alabama claims were sent to international arbitration in Geneva in 1872. And there, the British Prime Minister was Gladstone at this point. Gladstone agreed that the British government would pay out an indemnity of $15.5 million, which was a lot of money. Working out historical exchange rates, currency conversions, is a notoriously fuzzy business. There's so many different things to compare and so many things that don't line up and you can't compare. But my own estimates suggest that that much money, $15.5 million, in today's money, we're talking about something along the lines of $576 million if we were comparing retail price indices. If we're looking at the GDP deflator, we're looking at $795 million. If we're comparing annual average earnings, then and now, we're talking about $4.71 billion. If you're comparing GDP, per capita GDP, we're looking at $5.4 billion. And if you look at international share of the GDP, we're talking about $10.3 billion. So no matter how you cut it, you know, half a billion at the low end, 10 plus billion at the high end, that's a lot of money. And that's how much the British government paid to the U.S. government for the damages wrought by the Alabama before the Kearsarge finally caught up with her off the coast of Cherbourg Harbor in 1864. And that, perhaps, could be seen as the final chapter on British perspectives on, to some degree, British involvement in the American Civil War. The epilogue, then, might include the ins and outs of the special relationship through world wars and a Cold War and a post-9/11 war and everything else, right up to President and Mrs. Obama's state visit to the United Kingdom a couple weeks ago, what he and the British Prime Minister have called not the special relationship, but the essential relationship. That's going beyond what I want to talk about today. What perhaps is more relevant to today's discussion would be to point out that emigration from Britain to America accelerated in the decades following the Civil War. Before, this is a generalization, but I'll run with it. Before the 1860s and 70s and 80s, most people who left Britain were either convicts or paupers. They had been forced out of Britain by what demographers and historians like to call push factors. The notorious Highland clearances of Scotland in the late 18th, early 19th centuries would be one example. The hardship of the potato famine in the 1840s and 50s would be another. But increasingly, in the second half of the century, immigrants were attracted to America by so-called pull factors. That is, they were drawn in by perceived opportunities and advantages. And British immigrants to the United States, they tended to do fairly well. For one thing, unless they were Irish, they tended to be Protestant, so there was not the anti-Catholic stigma against them. For another thing, they tended to speak good English. They might be Welsh or Cornish or Scots and have a funny accent. They might be English and have a funny accent. They might be Irish and have a really funny accent, but they still tended to face a better prospect. They tended to be less exploited by employers and landlords and everything else. They faced less prejudice than the Eastern and Southern European immigrants of the second half of the 19th century. At one end of the socio-political ideological spectrum of late 19th century thought was the Scotsman Andrew Carnegie, whose family arrived in America destitute and who went on to become one of the world's richest men and a symbol of industry and management. At another end of that spectrum was Samuel Gompers, who also arrived in America pretty poor, and who ended up founding the American Federation of Labor. These two British-born Americans had and lived out very different takes on the American dream. And, of course, there were plenty more anonymous families and individuals who simply fell somewhere in between, and who contributed to the making of the United States and making it what it would become in the course of the next century and a half. In the course of the generation or so after the American Civil War, there were many voices on both sides of the Atlantic advocating a rapprochement and a closer union of Britain with the United States. This was something that was taken very, very seriously in many quarters for 60 or 70 years. It often was couched in terms of quartering the Union Jack with the Stars and Stripes, or the Stars and Stripes with the Union Jack. It was fueled in part from a consensus, or a sense of cultural and racial superiority shared by the Anglo-Saxon cousins on either side of the Atlantic. Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, another Virginia president, they were keenly interested in this from the perspective of the Americans. Rudyard Kipling and Cecil Rhodes, they were interested on the part of the British. So too was Winston Churchill. And it is with Winston Churchill that I would like to end my discussion this afternoon. For his background sheds light on one more interesting aspect of this phenomenon of Anglo-American relations that emerged in the post-Civil War era, and that was the Anglo-American dynastic marriage. The point was, and if you read Victorian society novels, or if you like Masterpiece Theater, the BBC, you'll know this already, but the point is that throughout the 19th century, a lot of British families, they had land and titles and houses and mortgages. And in many instances, they were completely broke. This actually also ties into the Anglo-American connection, but it's another story with grain prices and railways and things like that. All right, you have that on one side. And then 19th century America, it had plenty of self-made men who, I don't know, they had, they'd got their herd of 10,000 cattle in the slaughterhouse of Chicago a week before anybody else had. And they cornered that market and they made a huge killing. Or maybe somebody had struck it rich, literally, in the silver mines or the lead mines of Nevada or the gold mines of California. You can see where this is going. There are titles and status and mortgages on the one hand, and there are unbelievable amounts of wealth, but no social distinction on the other hand. Of course, every father wants what's best for his daughter, and every little girl wants to be a princess. Becoming a princess is probably out of the question, but what about becoming a duchess, or a marquesa, or a baroness, or at the very least becoming Lady So-and-so? Your daughter's dowry covers the mortgage, your son's title is bestowed in the family, and everyone is happy, and there were a lot of these. I was looking at a study of these recently, and the appendix was simply a list of some of the most important ones, and the appendix went on for 422 pages of these important marriages. Miss Mary Burns of New York City became Viscountess Harcourt. Miss Hattie Duran of San Francisco became Lady St. Simon. Miss Eliza Custis, who was actually George Washington's step-granddaughter, became the Baroness of Ellenborough. Miss Sarah Barker of Maine became the Countess of Carnarvon. Miss Nancy Witcher Langford of Danville, Virginia, became Lady Astor, and in her own right, she became the first female parliamentarian. Consuelo Vanderbilt of New York City became the Duchess of Marlborough, and so on, and so on, and so on. Another famous New York beauty, Jenny Jerome, she married the younger son of the Duke of Marlborough, whose maternal grandmother happened to be the Marquesa of Londonderry, so there are lots of titles coming to this, and she became, in her own right, the mother of Winston Churchill. And I tried to confirm this fact in the last couple of months, I've not been able to, but I'm pretty sure that I recall having read that when he was a young man, having sailed from Belfast to New York, he then took the train down, I believe, to Newport News. The young Winston Churchill stopped by Gordonsville, and he made a pilgrimage there to visit Maplewood Cemetery and the mass grave of 700-plus Confederate soldiers there. He then continued on his way to Havana, where he was a war correspondent there. But that, again, that might be something I imagined, because I haven't been able to confirm that. But what I do know is that he designed his four-volume Nobel Prize-winning Opus Magnum not as a history of Britain or as a history of England, but as a history of the English-speaking peoples. And if you read it, the fourth volume is called The Great Democracies. And if you read it, again, you'll see that the American Civil War assumes in it a very central place.